doing this sort of thinking about Jean McHale's comment 10 years ago that there's a danger in allowing opt-out to be seen as an entitlement gradually through guidance without the legitimacy and the boundaries of such an opt-out being subject to a thorough reconsideration. And then she suggested that there'd been a sanctioning of an incremental extension of opt-out across healthcare. So I'm quite interested in those ideas. So the first time that the idea of conscientious objection came into statute was in the 1898 Vaccination Act. The idea about somebody conscientiously believing that vaccination would be prejudicial to the health of the child. This is subsequently repealed by the NHS Act 1946, leaving us now with our two statutory protections, two conscientious objection, which I'm guessing we all know. So we've got the Abortion Act 1967 and the Human Fertilisation Embryology Act 1990. Both of them are talking about participating in a treatment or an activity authorised or governed by the Act, and then with the burden of proof being on the person who seeks to rely on that claimed conscientious objection. And I've always found it interesting that conscientious objection is only included in these two statutes in the healthcare context. I've always wondered why we haven't had it in more of the statutes. So why don't we have it in the Human Tissue Act, for example, or the Mental Capacity Act? Because both of those cover areas which some might view as controversial or might have some concerns about. So as I say, I think that's always interested me. So we might want to think about today then why, I mean, great if we could answer it, I doubt we will, but why we've got it in these two statutes, but also then if we are thinking that conscientious objection is something that's worth protecting and worth accommodating, why don't we go for a more sort of general conscientious clause, or however we want to frame it. And then I was thinking, well, maybe that's because we've got the European Convention, which in a way, does that act as our sort of general clause, our general cover-all? So we've got our Article 9, protecting the right to freedom of conscience, Article 8, protecting the right to autonomy via the respect for private and family lives, and that so might come into play perhaps in relation to conscientious objection. But of course, these aren't absolute rights. They're qualified, and they can be qualified by public interest considerations, such as protecting health or protecting the rights or freedoms of others. So if I was just looking at statute, that would be me done now. But unfortunately, there's more for me to have a look at. So going back to Jean McHale's article in 2009, where she suggested that a health professional's ability to opt out had been incrementally expanded and sanctioned. She said that this had happened in relation to withdrawing life-sustaining treatment, and she gave two examples. So in ReB about a doctor, if they're unable to carry out the wishes of a patient in terms of withdrawing life-sustaining treatment, then their duty is to find other doctors who will do so. And then we've got a comment in the Mental Capacity Act's Code of Practice from 2007, again noting that some healthcare professions may disagree with patients' right to refuse life-sustaining treatment. Then it says, the Mental Capacity Act does not change the current legal situation. They do not have to do something that goes against their belief. So there, is it implied, is it clear, in the sense that doctors, health professionals can refuse to withdraw treatment from somebody who wants it to be withdrawn. Okay, so those were the examples that Jean gave. So I thought it'd be interesting to have a look then how this has played out in the guidance that we've got. So I've looked first then at the regulators, and we've got Nursing and Midwifery Council, and in their code they talk about having a conscientious objection to a particular procedure. So I sort of panicked a little bit at this, or the alarm bells went off thinking, blimey, what do we mean by that? That seems really wide. But actually, if you look down in the smaller point at the bottom of the page in the code, it says you can only make a conscientious objection in limited circumstances, and then you're referred to the council's website, which then takes you to the specific guidance, which makes it clear that conscientious objection is only protected in the two statutes. So it seems to me that the Nursing and Midwifery Council are following the statutes then. That's what they're saying for their nurses, midwives and nursing associates. I think there's a different position in relation to doctors, where we've got the General Medical Council talking about having a conscientious objection to a particular procedure. We've got this both in their general guidance for medical practice and again in their personal beliefs and medical practice. So they say that you can choose to opt out of providing a particular procedure because of your personal beliefs and values, as long as this does not result in direct or indirect discrimination against or harassment of a patient or group of patients. And I looked also at the Irish Medical Council, which I know that Barry's going to have a look at later, and it seems to me that they take a similarly wide view here, where they talk about you may refuse to provide or take part in the provision of lawful treatments or forms of care which conflict with your sincerely held ethical or moral values. Now, this may well be because the law, the protection of conscientious objection statute in Ireland is different, but I just was noting how the similarities there with the GMC and the Irish Medical Council. So I also had a look at the position of pharmacists, and we've got from the General Pharmaceutical Council. They say their sort of one of their fundamental ideas, their first standard is the idea that pharmacy professionals must provide person-centred care. And they then give examples of the attitudes and behaviours that are expected in order to meet this standard. So they talk about pharmacy professionals recognising their own values and beliefs but not imposing them on other people, taking responsibility for ensuring that person-centred care is not compromised because of personal values and beliefs. So, say, but in all of this, there is this idea that person-centred care must be at the centre of everything that they do. So, on the face of it, there's no indication that they are limiting or not limiting this to the two statutory areas. So, if we look, though, at their specific guidance, they talk in terms of pharmacy professionals feeling unable or to provide certain services. And if you look at the examples, then, we've got contraception, we've got hormonal therapies, we've got mental health and well-being, we've got substance misuse. So again, we seem to be going beyond the two areas covered by statute. So those are sort of primarily the general guidance. And I also, the BMA, sorry Ruth. So we've got then the BMA, we've got both in their medical ethics today and in their specific guidance on doctors' beliefs, talking about doctors should only claim a conscientious exemption to the procedures where statute recognises their right and to withdrawing life-prolonging treatment from a patient who lacks capacity. So the BMA does recognise that the second point about withdrawing life-prolonging treatment is not covered by statute, so it's not a legally recognised right, but the BMA would strongly support a request by a doctor to exercise a conscientious objection in the latter case. So again, it seems to me then that there is this push or this move within the professional guidance in terms of what bodies will or will not accept. So that leaves us, I think, with the GMC talking in terms of particular procedure. We've got the General Pharmaceutical Council talking about services, and then the BMA talking about two statutes and this idea of withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment from adults without capacity. We've also got from the BMA this comment that the BMA believes that there's no reason why reasonable and lawful requests by doctors to exercise a conscientious objection to other procedures should not be considered. So this wouldn't be seen as a right, but individual requests should be assessed on their merits. So that seems to me that then you can make a claim to consciously object to any procedure or treatment. We could have a look at some of the guidance in relation to specific treatments. So we've got, in terms of contraception, for example, we've got the BMA talking in terms of providing contraceptive advice or treatment, saying that a doctor could have a conscientious objection to that, and if they do, then there's an ethical duty to refer the patient. So you might have thought, or I might have thought, that with contraception, the BMA would just be talking in terms of the types of contraception that some people might think of as being similar to early abortion. But here they're talking about providing contraceptive advice or treatment. So again, that seems to me much wider. I've already noted the BMA's position about the withdrawing life-sustaining treatment. We've got a similar comment from the GMC, but also note here that the GMC is talking about a situation where you can object to a patient's decision to refuse treatment, and also a situation where we're looking at withdrawing treatment where the patient lacks the capacity to decide. So basically, in any situation where a patient, where we're talking about the withdrawal of a treatment from a patient, it seems to me the GMC is saying that there can be a conscientious objection. And again, this is recognised in the BMA guidance in relation to clinically assisted nutrition and hydration. They're just looking at adults who lack capacity, again noting the conscientious objection should be thought about and should be recognised as a potential conflict of interest and handing over this aspect of the patient's care to a colleague. But there it is noted that there is no statutory right to claim a conscientious objection in this regard. And then I guess not surprisingly, in relation to assisted dying, over 20 years ago, we've got comment from the BMA that if the law were to change in relation to assisted dying, then this would be a matter for individuals' doctors' conscience, subject to professional guidance issued by the regulatory body. So over to the GMC for that then. And then we've got, I just pulled out a couple of examples from some of the many bills have come before the Parliament in relation to this, where we've got an early example where there was going to be a duty to refer a patient, but then there was a question raised as to whether or not a duty to refer would be a breach of Article 9. Ian, you might have something to say about that later, I don't know, or comment on that. And so it's changed in one of the later bills, where it became the conscientious objection clause became more based on that we've seen already in the Abortion Act and Human Fertilisation Act. So we moved to participating in anything authorised, so there is no duty there to refer. And then finally, I thought interesting, we've got a comment from the Royal Pharmaceutical Society talking about that there should be a prerequisite that a conscience clause is incorporated into any assisted suicide legislation. So there must be no obligation for any pharmacist to participate in any aspect of an assisted suicide or similar procedure if they feel this is against their personal beliefs. And I think it's really important, particularly when we do talk about assisted dying, if we do go on to talk about it in our discussions, is that pharmacists often get sort of missed out of our consideration. We tend to focus on the doctors and the nurses. But actually, in a separate project that Mary and I have been doing, where we've been looking at pharmacists, they have got really strong sort of thoughts about this and this feeling of being excluded from discussions and debates. So as I say, we need to bear them in mind when we talk. So I thought I'd also just quickly then run through what we have in terms of how we should deal with conscientious objection in practice. We don't have anything in the statutes, but from the Dugan case in 2014, we've got Lady Hale saying that conscientious objector is under an obligation to refer the case to a professional who does not share that objection. And she was talking in the sense of the professional's duty of care to the patient would mean then that there would be this obligation. And that then builds on an earlier comment from Barham Matthews in 1999 about this didn't talk in terms of a duty, but this sort of sense of you should be referring on. But as I say, there's nothing in statute about that. If we look then at the regulators, perhaps Nursing and Midwifery Council are asking for more than just a referral, because they're talking about arranging for a suitably qualified colleague to take over responsibility for the person's care. But telling colleagues, manager, and the person receiving care if you have a conscientious objection to a particular procedure. Similar points from the GMC about being open with employers, partners or colleagues, exploring with them how you can practice in accordance with your beliefs without compromising patient care and without overburdening your colleagues, which I thought was really interesting as well, this note and this recognition that the patient may be affected by a conscientious objection, but so too may your colleagues, depending on the context within you, which you're working. So again, that's something that we should be alert to. Also about doing your best to make sure that patients who may consult you about the service or procedure that you object to, that they're aware of your objection in advance. About telling the patient that you don't provide the particular treatment, telling that they have the right to access or go and discuss that with somebody else, making sure they have enough information so they can arrange to see somebody else. And then, again, this idea of perhaps more than referral, saying that if the patient can't themselves arrange to see another doctor, then you should be making that arrangements for them. And all of this GMC guidance is perhaps not surprisingly repeated by the Medical Defence Union in their on their website. For the Irish Medical Council, we've got very similar obligations in terms of telling other people, so informing patients, colleagues and your employer. But then when you discuss these with patients, be sensitive and considerate so you minimise any distress. And the idea of making sure that patients' care is not interrupted, again, the same points about informing the patient and giving them enough information. And if they can't arrange a transfer of their care, then make the arrangements on their behalf. And I thought it was quite interesting, but the General Pharmaceutical Council, I think they give the most comprehensive guidance on sort of how to deal with conscientious objections. So I've not pulled all of it out for you today, just some points for it that you might want to think about. So they say that pharmacy professionals should think in advance about the areas of their practice which may be affected and making the necessary arrangements because of this idea of them not finding themselves in a position where a person's care could be compromised. So pharmacy professionals should be telling their employer as soon as possible if they have religious, personal values or beliefs that might prevent them from providing certain pharmacy services. Ideas of working in partnership with their employer to make sure that adequate and appropriate arrangements are put in place. Also talking about referrals, saying that this may be an appropriate option, but perhaps more than just referral, because it might actually be a handover to another pharmacist at the same or another pharmacy or service provider, recognising that referral might not be appropriate in every situation, and about pharmacy professionals using their professional judgment to decide what is appropriate in individual cases. And then thinking about the pharmacy professional who does have the objection then should take steps to make sure that the person asking for care is at the centre of their decision making, so they can access the service they need in a timely manner and without hindrance. And then for the BMA, we sort of move into the areas that go beyond statute, and we look at doctors who oppose contraception or the termination of pregnancy, informing patients who want the services about how they can access them elsewhere. About them, doctors making it clear if they have a conscientious objection to abortion, fertility treatment, or withdrawing treatment from a patient who lacks capacity. But again, the idea of informing of the right to see another doctor, giving them sufficient information, making the arrangement if they can't make it for themselves. Referral then, so in terms of contraceptive advice or treatment, saying that there's an ethical duty to refer to another practitioner or family planning service. And then I have noted that in two of the documents from the BMA, it seems to me that perhaps we're talking about more than just a referral. So we're talking about abortion, fertility treatment and withdrawing life-prolonging treatment for patients who lack capacity, about there being a doctor being in a position to take over the care. So it's not just enough to, it's like there has to be somebody else I can hand you over to. And that's repeated then in the withholding or withdrawing life-prolonging guidance from 2007. And similarly, we've got from the GMC talking about you mustn't first withdraw from providing care on grounds of conscientious objection without ensuring that arrangements have been made for another doctor to take over your role. In, from the RCP and the BMA, we're talking about seeing conscientious objection, as I've already noted, in terms of a potential conflict of interest, declaring this prior to beginning discussions within the healthcare team or with those close to the patient. Not clear exactly who we're declaring that to, but that's an interesting notion. And then if an individual clinician can't sanction a best interest decision to withdraw clinical assisted nutrition and hydration, then they should hand over the care of the patient. So again, more than just referral. And then right at the bottom of the slide, I just put another point that doesn't necessarily fit in with the rest of the guides, but I thought it was really important, so again, we might want to come back to today. This idea, so in the guidance itself, it says, what steps can be taken to support widespread implementation of the guidance? And it says, putting in place a process whereby doctors with a conscientious objection can notify senior colleagues and managers, and a process for alternative arrangements to be made. And given that we're talking about the how today, I just thought that was a really important point that, again, we might want to think about. So it seems to me then, and I know that was a really quick run through, and I do apologise. I know there were a lot of slides, and I have tried to cut them down as much as possible, but I hope you've got a flavour or a sense that some of the current guidance, maybe quite a lot of the current guidance, seems to go beyond then our statutory protected two areas and seems to be pushing at the boundaries of where we're saying conscientious objection should be allowed. And that's not necessarily a problem. I think what is a problem is that the guidance isn't always as clear as it might be, and there perhaps are some conflicts within the guidance, particularly perhaps in relation to the BMA and the GMC. And so I wonder if the obligations of and on health professionals are as transparent as they could be, and also then do patients really know what's going on here? So thinking about the health professionals, must they refer the patient to another health professional who will provide the objected to treatment? What happens if they don't refer them? Must they inform the patients in advance of their objections? And again, if they don't inform them, what happens? And as I say then, I think there are some subtle differences in the positions of the BMA and the GMC and whether or not that causes problems in practice. So go back to an earlier point that I made, is then whether or not it's more appropriate to take conscientious objection out of specific statutes, and do we go then for a sort of more general conscience clause which would apply to any and all treatments or procedures? And we can talk about whether that would be a good idea, and also then whether we would want that in statute itself or whether we'd want that in professional guidance. But as I say, it seems to me that what's important is clarifying the legal position for health professionals and for patients, because I'm not sure I'm particularly clear about the scope of the obligations here. And as I say, I think that's particularly worrying given that we are seem to be pushing and going beyond the two areas protected by statute. Now, I thought that that's what the conscientious objection medical activity bill, when it first came on my radar, that's what I thought it was going to do. But actually, it just seems to me to be adding in the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment to our two areas that were already covered. So it just seems to me to be incorporating the GMC's position, or seeking to incorporate the GMC's position into statute. And whether or not we think that's appropriate, I guess, is another matter. But I thought the bill was going to do something, but it turned out to be doing something different to maybe what I hoped it would do. So those are just the provisions there. So again, I just really want to go back to the comment from Jean McHale about there being a danger in allowing opt-out to be seen as an entitlement gradually through guidance without the legitimacy and the boundaries of such an opt-out being subject to a thorough reconsideration. So I, you know, we need to think about the effects that this might have on health professionals and how we should be or could be accommodating conscientious objection within a publicly funded National Health Service. And really that is what we're looking at today. So thanks very much.